Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand, owner of the company Horns of Odin. Before we get into today's show, I do have to do our plugs because it's how we literally keep the lights on, how we keep the podcast going. So if you do want to support the podcast, and if you can support the podcast, the best way is through our Patreon, and you get a bonus episode every week in the form of a Q&A. And then on top of that, we do bonus episodes for the bonus episodes, which are either story times where we do a reading with either Jonas Lorentzen or Claire Moulet. And we also do a creator episode where somebody from the Viking crafts world comes on and shows us how they do their craft, what their inspirations are, their techniques. They'll demonstrate it on the show. It's a lot of fun. These have been liked by a lot of people. So if you do like that, it's just patreon.com/ Nordic Mythology Podcast. It starts from £3 a month, so it's 10p a day. It's the cost of a coffee, probably cheaper than a cup of coffee once a month. And you get the whole back catalog of every bonus episode we've ever done is also on there, and you can binge listen to them. So yeah, there's months, even probably even years of stuff you can check out, of just extra material. So yeah, please do that. If you can't, obviously not everyone can financially support, but even just a positive review wherever you get your podcast, or you know, a little like, share on our Instagram, it all appeases the algorithm gods, because we all have to play that game now and try and, I don't know if tickle the balls of the algorithm gods is the right phrase, but I'm going with it. So I've said it now, it's out there. That's what we're going to do. So if you,
here we are.
If you do want to tickle the proverbial balls of the algorithm god, please help us just like and share it on all the different social media platforms, just at Nordic Mythology Podcast. And I guess on that, let's start the show. So I'm joined today by my lovely co-host, Margaret Havgar, who you're here pretty much all month, hopefully.
All of March, at least, yeah.
All March, and then we're going to see from there, and hopefully I'm going to wrangle you into being here every week.
We'll see. I do have a PhD I need to finish writing, so we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, you know.
PhD, schmehd.
Yeah, exactly. And then we're joined today by our guest, Declan Taggart, who is Northern Irish, and we're recording this on St. Paddy's Day. So either that's an amazing coincidence or great booking. I'm not sure which.
It really just shows that I haven't looked at my calendar at all until right now.
It could be that
I should be doing something more exciting. I mean, this is very exciting, don't get me wrong, but something more stereotypical, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know what it says about your social circle that you're stuck here with us two on a lovely St. Patrick's Sunday evening.
I mean, if it helps, I'm wearing green and orange, and I'm really pale. So
it just says that my social circle is getting better.
Green. But yeah, probably, yeah. Yeah, it does. Declan, can you give us a little intro into who you are, what you do, what we're going to talk about?
Sure. Thank you very much for having me on. It's a pleasure to meet you both. And I'm excited to get one of the Margareth episodes. It's going to be all four of them. That's cool. So I'm a researcher at the University of Iceland. I've just started a new project looking at, I suppose, warriors in the Viking Age, which is very exciting. That's a collaborative project I'm doing with people across some other really good researchers across Scandinavia and Iceland. I did a project about morality and Old Norse religion before this one, looking at there's an idea that's been held for a long time that the Old Norse gods weren't seen to care about their worshippers' behavior in life. You know, I think it's probably because a lot of the people researching it were Christians. And so just to have this assumption that pagans couldn't have sin, couldn't have this kind of like concept of human action, and that the gods wouldn't be interested in it. If anything, the gods were a negative influence in life rather than a positive one. Mm-hmm. So that was fun. It was a really fun project. And actually, while doing that project, I wrote a game, which you very kindly said I can plug here at the start.
Absolutely.
It's called Choice of the Viking. And that's because it was written for a company called Choice of Games, an American company. And it's a choose your own adventure, which maybe your audience will know.
I'm sure they will.
Yeah. So it's basically like you're reading a novel, and every so often, every half a page or page, you make a decision about what will happen next. Like, do you want to fight a dragon? Do you want to make friends with the dragon? Do you want to romance a dragon? You know, that kind of stuff. Yeah. All three. Yeah.
Yes.
Sadly, you can only choose one. So it's basically a digital version of that, which you can buy at Steam and Play Store and places. And hopefully it's fun. It's based on Eyrbyggja Saga, which is about the settlement of Iceland. It doesn't stick very closely to the original story, but it takes like the magic and the ghosts and the draugr, the zombie type creatures, and the kind of conflict of religion from there, puts it in, and farming. There's a lot of farming. And puts it together.
It's an accurate game then, isn't it?
I tried to make it as accurate as to the story, to the feel of the story, I think. It's a bit violent, so maybe that should be warned.
Also accurate.
It's true. But hopefully it's fun. It's a bit more irreverent. It's like, as a piece of Viking fiction, it's not so gritty. It's a bit more... I read a lot of Neil Gaiman, Douglas Adams growing up, things like that, teach Terry Pratchett. So hopefully some of that comes across. But yeah.
Anyway. That sounds like such a cool combo.
I mean, I wish it was as good as those three writers put together. But
No. You don't get to diss your own game while you're plugging it.
But, hopefully, I enjoyed making it, and I think some people liked it when they played it. So hopefully, more people will.
Mm-hmm. I know what I'm doing after work hours this week. Now.
You're very kind. Anyway, before the game, I suppose the reason I'm on here is that I researched Thor for my PhD, and then eventually published a book about the old Norse god Thor, and really about his mythology and how it changes over time. Yeah, so. That's a big thing. A lot of articles and stuff like that too, you know?
Yeah. So we're here to talk about Thor. Before we get into that, I'm just gonna go off on a complete wild tangent just because
I'm sure.
Sounds good. Okay. talk about Thor next time. That's fine. I listened before. I know what happens.
We're gonna talk about Thor, I promise. But I figured how many times I'm gonna have a scholar in here on St. Patrick's Day, and I just wanted to ask about this whole myth and argument about like St. Patrick kicking all the pagans out of Ireland. And I don't know if that's anything you would know about, but I thought I'd just ask anyway. Maybe it was something that Margaret knew about, because I always see these memes on Facebook every St. Patrick's Day about like modern day pagans getting really upset about people celebrating St. Patrick's Day because kicking the snakes out of Ireland was actually kicking all the pagans out. And I just never really knew how accurate or true that was. And I didn't know whether that was something maybe you would know as an Irishman. That could be very stereotypical of me to assume that every Irishman would know the answer to this.
Well, I really don't know the answer at all. But I do know that I was taught that St. Patrick was great when I went to primary school. So, and that definitely all of the things people say about him are true. So I don't know, does that help? That's the only learning I have really with St. Patrick. I used some people who did research in Patrick, and mostly they just said to me that the stories of his life, he's really not, he doesn't come across as a nice guy in the sort of the saint's life.
That's the same thing that I've heard when I've looked into him. It's like, does come across a bit like a dick.
Yeah. A little bit. Yeah.
Bit of an asshole.
There was a Saint Declan beforehand.
Oh, of course there was.
Where's his press?
I feel like you've just taken the opportunity there to make up a saint and just put it out there and like, there's a saint named after me, Jamie Paul Patrick. I should be the patron saint of Ireland.
He might not have come beforehand. I can't really confirm that.
Well, you heard it here, it did. 100%.
It's canon now.
Yeah. Okay, let's... we'll get into Thor then. I won't ask you about things that you...
Actually, Dan, can I have a tangent question?
Absolutely.
Yes, because I was wondering, since you said you're now part of a research project in Iceland about warriors in the Viking Age, I might be completely wrong here, but is that in any way associated with the research project on warriors in the Viking Age with the University of Stavanger?
The University of Oslo.
University of Oslo, yeah.
Is it the Viking Museum, I think, connected to the university? The PI is Marian Moon?
Fedele? Oh, Moon? Oh, yeah. She's my boss.
Cool. Okay. So she's my boss, too.
Yay!
Nice.
Hello, fellow colleague, extended, twice removed.
So I've never actually met her in real life so far because we kind of constructed this across the internet, you know? But she's great. She's really, really good, really smart. So I'm
she
really
is so
I
sweet.
Should mention there's also a guy called Ben Rathfield. He's another archaeologist along with Marianne. And there's a historian of religion called Sophie Bunding from Denmark, who they're both great. They're my other colleagues. And Christian Cushmans. I've never heard his name pronounced out loud because he didn't say it to me. But he's Belgian and he's also very clever.
Awesome. So, I mean, there's so many of us. There's so many of us, so I can't really keep track of everyone doing everything.
Yeah.
But
yeah, of course.
A lot of those names sounded very familiar.
Awesome.
Okay, that was my tangent question. Now we can get into Thor.
How small is the world that it's your colleagues ish?
I guess it would be the same boss.
Peers, certainly.
Peers, yeah, I like
word.
That.
Better word, nice. Okay, so Thor is clearly a very, I'd say, the most famous of all the Norse gods. Whether it's down to, I would say he's more, even in modern day, more famous than Odin on a broad scale out to like the general public. I think whether it's down to maybe the Marvel movies or...
I think you can scratch the maybe from that sentence, Dan.
Yeah. I like to just cover my own back sometimes just in case. but he definitely is. And obviously I've read... Terry Gunnell did a very, very interesting article on the idea of Thor maybe being like the head of the pantheon in Nordic mythology. And there is a ton of Milners that are found, and it seems like he was, and obviously place names named after Thor. So it seems like the chances are maybe he was the most popular historically as well. I don't know where I was going with that. That was just stating all the things that I knew about Thor. But,
so, I bet you know more, if I'm honest. I think you know even more than that.
Probably do. I probably could have. So I guess, what would be the start? What do you think the starting point would be in terms of this figure that everybody knows? And I guess, do we start by maybe looking at what we do know to be historical fact? Because I imagine it's a case of there's so much that we know versus the absolute mass that isn't true and has been changed and adapted to and added to over the past 1,000 years.
I hate to be like a bummer, like academic.
No, go ahead,
answer,
do it, please.
But
I can't be the only one.
Much, you know. Yeah.
But I like that answer because that's what we're here for.
So, I mean, I think I'm sure your audience know, especially people that are regularly listening to the podcast. But most of the mythology that we have, especially, comes from one place. It comes from Iceland. In manuscripts that were from the 13th, 14th century onwards. From Sweden, for example, we don't have any myths that I can think of off the top of my head that are definitely about Thor that come from Sweden and nowhere else. You can see these connections between these two places. For example, in Iceland, we have plenty of myths of Thor going fishing, which I think is always a spectacularly mundane activity to put in a myth. Obviously, he's fishing a serpent so big that it wraps around the world, but still, you know, that's really fun. But you see that on stones, for example, in Sweden. So you can tell there are connections between these two places. But we can't... Also, there's a lot of variety between these two places in terms of the image of Thor we get, even just using those sort of scraps of information. So we can't tell... We don't have all of... Obviously, we don't have every myth was ever composed about him. We probably only have a small fraction of this myth, really. Mostly coming from probably... We don't know how old he was. We don't have anything from the Iron Age in terms of mythology, for example. And even the myths that we have might not represent everybody's viewpoint. Whether that's
talking
on whether or not he's the head of the gods, or just on even, for example, his association with thunder and lightning. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's... My long-winded way of slightly disagreeing with you, sorry.
No, I love that. That was the best answer.
Yeah. So, okay, then I guess what do we know from as the from mythology as to like what can we say this is what people thought or saw. Let's start physically, because I think for most people Thor has a very like physical appearance. They can, if most people, if they close their eyes now, they would probably get the Marvel Thor figure. But even then, obviously, iconically has his hammer. You hear things about, does he have apparently some magical gauntlets, a belt?
The belt's pretty well known, yeah.
Like, how accurate are these things? Like, what do we, his hair color, I guess, as well. Like, physically, what do we know for?
Well, we could take the hair color as an example. The hair color, he's described in sagas from the 13th century onwards as being red bearded, at least, I think. But we don't have any evidence from before that period, before these Christians composing these tales about the settlement, that he was ginger. But he definitely has a beard, for sure. There's one myth that describes him with a beard. I think maybe in most of the iconography is pretty simple. So it's just a circle, for example, in the Altuna Stone with two slots for eyes, basically. But there's a small figurine from Iceland that's probably Thor, where he's sort of playing with his beard, possibly creating wind. That's one argument about that figurine. So I get, he definitely has a beard. Whether he's a red beard in the Viking Age is much harder to say. Even physically, we don't get descriptions of gods very often, and we often don't know who the gods are in the iconography we have in the images from, whether that's Northumbria, for example, or Scandinavia. We can't be sure which god's which unless, for example, they're fishing. Then it's probably Thor. The mythology, Thor eats a lot. You know, the idea of him is that he's this hyper-masculine. We can say one thing about Thor, he's hyper-masculine. He's the most masculine figure that you could possibly get. And that's why sometimes the myths make fun of that and undercut it and play with it. Dress him up in women's clothing, for example, or maybe even the short hammer thing that might originally have been a joke at his expense.
He's the most masculine that ever masculined.
Yeah, essentially. So probably he ate a lot. He was huge. Probably he was supposed to be depicted in this way. And then this one of my favorite poems, which I go on about a lot and nobody cares about, is this poem called Hallamundarkvida, which I think is probably from the 1200s in Iceland. So actually probably composed by Christians. And these Christians envision Thor sort of rambling through the landscape, hunting trolls, let's say, like essentially giants in the Icelandic landscape. And they're so big, all of them, that they're causing volcanic activity. They're causing like eruptions, like mudslides, and actual, you know, earthquakes to be happening all around them. So that Thor is huge, obviously, as well. And I don't think the Thor of the actual myths, when he's fighting he's got a human sidekick. So how big could they be as well? Anyway.
Yeah.
I think it's very circumstantial, probably, how he would have appeared. But there's definitely some common features like the beard, as you mentioned. But even with that, you can't be sure if he's even ginger.
Yeah. I also find like proportions to be very interesting when it comes to like the myths and what we know about, like, for example, the fishing story, like the iterations that I've read that are translated, obviously, that I always found like the description of him pulling the Midgardsorm to him, like with his feet going through the bottom of the ship and like him planting them at the bottom of the sea. And I'm like, how does that work exactly?
Yeah. Really, really,
how did he not sink the boat if his feet are that big? And I'm like,
genuinely have the same query. 100%. Yeah.
And I'm like, Max, this is a myth, like suspension of, you know, disbelief and everything. Yeah. And I'm like, yes, but this is ruining my suspension.
He's got really long legs. Have you ever seen the cartoon Inspector Gadget?
Well, yes, obviously. I'm a proud child of the 90s. Of course I've seen Inspector Gadget.
There's your answer. He's got go-go gadget legs.
Okay. I was going to say, how did he possibly fit in the boat? But you preempted that brilliantly. Yeah.
See, Dan just comes in here and just schools us academics. I love it.
That's true.
You know, sometimes it takes a simple mind.
I listen to the podcast quite a lot. You're so self-effacing, man.
I know. I'm working on it, but I haven't gotten far.
Yeah. You know, you seem very clever. Just saying.
Who, me?
Yeah. You always ask great questions. Very incisive.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'll start blushing. I don't take compliments. I don't take compliments very well. Okay, so we've learned that he has a beard. That's pretty much what we've got.
Probably. Let's say probably. Just in case.
Also, probably has a beard.
No, yeah, you're right. He almost definitely does.
He has mentioned at certain points having a beard. That in certain periods he did not shave.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure. But most of the gods probably have beards also. That's another thing to mention. Like this one nickname for Odin that's horse hair mustache, I think.
Oh, nice.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool.
So.
So one argument I've had a lot with people is everybody who's seen like the God of War depiction of Thor with like the big red beard and like the big power belly from almost like a weightlifter. And people say, well, he eats a lot in the myths. Like this would make sense for him to look like that. Is there anything to suggest that that's true? Because I always prescribe the notion that he's a god. He can look like however the hell gods look, really. I don't think the same laws of calories apply to gods as they do mere humans. But yeah, do we know, is there anything that says like, other than he eats and drinks a lot, that would suggest either he is that kind of rotund, heavy, strongman type, or the Chris Hemsworth steroid-induced ripped type?
I don't think there's anything in particular. I mean, there might be. There definitely could be, and it's just, you know, slipping out of my mind. I'd probably go to the iconography more than anywhere else. And he's, I guess, slightly round in that as well. But it's, I mean, the iconography, it's on stone. So there's only so much you can do when you're incising. You've got to go for quite definite lines. You know, you can't be messing around with zigzags, for example.
Yeah. It's famously quite difficult.
Okay.
So the Erland figurine from Iceland, which is the one I mentioned before, where he's got his beard and it's kind of going into his hammer. I mean, he's normalish sized, I suppose. He's not extremely proportioned in any way.
I mean, I suppose also the way, like how his body shape would be, would also then, if he is like the masculine that ever masculined, I suppose people's perception of what he would have looked like would then have depended on what was kind of considered to be masculine proportions at any given time.
Yeah.
I would say that's very likely. And as you mentioned before, Dan, you can compare the Chris Hemsworth now with even the Valhalla comics. I don't know if you know them from Denmark in the 90s, I think they were published maybe into the 2000s.
I don't think I have.
They're really good comics. Quite different from the Marvel ones. And he has a red beard in them and he has that more classical figurine. It's a bit rounder. So even that depends on obviously the individual artist's view and probably social trends as well.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Okay, so we don't know for certain. I didn't know whether there was a description in any myth or anything like that. But
again, there could be, but I can't think of it off the top of my head.
I feel like you would remember it if there was.
I mean, not that I'm super well versed in all of the myths, but I gotta say that now that you mention it, Declan, that as far as I can remember, there are surprisingly few physical descriptions of gods, besides like if there are specific things that have happened, like Sif's hair being shaved or something. But then that's it's something that happened to her, but it's not like that their physique is necessarily given a lot of attention like we maybe expect from the way that we write stories today.
It could be that there are descriptions somewhere and I don't remember them as you don't either. But I don't think, for example, Loki's ever described as super slender, even though every depiction of in the 20th century of Loki, he's always this slender sort of guileful character.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if it was just a case of everybody just knew what they looked like, I guess.
Yeah, I think so.
Maybe like it wasn't put into the myths because it was just kind of passed on through normal tradition and conversation. You just knew.
You would have had idols and...
Yeah, but like, also like, okay, possible tangent incoming, but I just started thinking about the concept of Haugen Fylgjir and Hamskifte, of like skin changing that like maybe their physique isn't necessarily what you would use to recognize them, but it's their personality and their attributes and their accessories and how they behave that that's what kind of gives you an input to recognize a god, not necessarily if they have a red beard or not. Because technically, if we go by the little we do know by, please interrupt me and disagree if you want, Declan, but like I'm just thinking maybe you wouldn't necessarily recognize them from a face, but more like they could change shape, theoretically, it seems, at least Odin.
The most famous story, probably, especially in relation to Thor, of the shapeshifting, is Frey's the person that owns the skin that they use. I mean, we don't have that many references to that kind of process, I guess, happening in myths. And it being just in Freya, that might just be an accident of survival. It might be that many of the gods did, but they make such a big deal of Freya actually having had it that maybe that suggests that she was the only one who did. But I mean, you're definitely right that nobody really knows what Odin looks like. That's part of his, nobody recognizes him when he's wandering through the countryside. So he could clearly change a lot. I wonder if Thor is the god that you're most likely to recognize. I don't want to talk about Freyr from this point of view, because if you've seen is it the Raelinga figurine? There's a little figurine that people associate with Freyr over the other gods.
Yeah, I have a lot of issues with figurines being interpreted as gods unless they're very specific attributes, as to like you say, like the fishing scene, like then I'm like, okay, I'm inclined to believe it. But if they're just like, oh, this must definitely be a god, I'm like, please
this one's
describe
a fertility.
Why.
This is I'm a fertility like, god for sure.
Oh my god.
But I mean, there might be something in what you say, for sure, that they could shapeshift, that maybe they weren't expected to be seen. Probably. I don't know. I could get very speculative.
Go ahead.
In terms, well, maybe not speculative. Maybe it's there's a big difference between myth and, let's say, prayer or more sort of theological understandings of gods. When you think of your God, when you think of the Christian God, even you think of that person in the sky. You know, that old man with the beard. And obviously, Jesus is a person that was a person. Historically, I think. So they're definitely people. But whenever you're praying to the Christian God, if you're a Christian, you're maybe not always, there's not always this human-like image you have. You just have this like more sensation, this more abstract concept. So maybe the Old Norse gods had this kind of duality as well. And that's, I spent a long time with one of my previous projects looking at the idea of omniscience of the Norse gods. Could the Old Norse gods see you? Were they expected to see you or not?
Ooh.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, I think there's a split there, probably, for me, between myth and you conceptualizing it of these gods as humans. But let's say you write to a god on a runestone, or let's say you write on a little brooch or something, you wrote a little protective charm, you flip that over, nobody can see that. Like, no matter how human-like they are. So what's happening there? And that seems like you're dealing with another way of conceptualizing gods. You aren't expecting them to be people-like. You're just expecting that, especially if you write something, they'll pay attention to that somehow. So, you know, there's multiple sort of cognitions, multiple ways of thinking about gods.
That's a really interesting point.
Thank you.
That also makes so much sense that it's like, yeah, okay, human-like in myths maybe, but then there's also this extra level of like, the just seeing things that human-like creature won't see by default.
Yeah.
And there's this level in presence or consciousness.
Yeah, I think so. I think they get mixed up too. I think some of that, what's the word? Like those inferences, that those feelings that people have about their gods, I think that goes into the writing of stories about the gods too. You have this feeling that the god will be watching you. So, for example, then Odin has a chair that's magic and he can watch people from it. He has these birds that fly around and watch people. And I think probably that comes from that feeling in the Thor stories. Just, you know, I can tie it all back together. In
that's
the Thor
neat.
Stories, there's not so much of that. Thor isn't really a god that seems to watch, but he's a protective god. You asked earlier about what's the core of Thor? And I think being a protector, being really strong, but also looking after the people in your community, that's really what he's about. And so when somebody calls out Thor in the myths, twice anyway, and the slightly sketchy pieces of evidence, they're probably very late, but Thor suddenly comes running, you know, when people use his name. So maybe that's also related to that sense of, you know, being watched by your god, looked after, being cared for by your god.
Yeah. I want to save that because I want to get back to that, because I would like to go into the Christian influences into the myth and how maybe that stripped away some of that like omnipresence, I guess, and whether they've tried to humanize them to kind of make them a little less god-like.
Yeah.
But to keep on the theme of maybe physicality and just to keep some sort of structure-ish as we move through the landscape that is Thor. When it comes to his lovely accessories, what do we know to be true? What's kind of mentioned as him having? Because like I say, I think I've heard obviously the hammer, gauntlet, and maybe the belt, and this idea of the Mjolnir can shrink into a pendant to be worn around the neck. Is that like a historic?
That's more the shrinking thing. That could, again, I feel silly half the time. I'm like, is that a thing? I don't think him shrinking Mjolnir is a thing to be worn around the neck. That's more like Freyr has a boat, Thorstein's Blatnir, that shrinks, and you can put it in your pocket, which is really useful if you're like a Viking on
super useful.
Yeah, you can. Anytime you need to, like, you can't go down a bit of a river, you can just put the boat in your pocket, walk, and then jump back in the boat again when the river's traversable.
I wonder if that came from when they were traveling across through sort of Europe area, and they would put the ships onto wooden rollers and push them from.
It definitely
river
makes
to,
me think of that. Yeah.
River to river and work around, and they're like, "Fuck, this would be so much easier if this boat could just shrink up and be put in the pocket right now."
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I can't say for sure, but it makes me think of that too.
Yeah.
Definitely. Regarding Thor's other sort of bits of clothing, I guess.
Yeah.
I think, not talking about the hammer for a second, the other ones, I don't think they come up very much. The belt, for example, I think it appears obviously in Snorra Edda, which... Mm-hmm. Probably your listeners know Snorra Edda if you're into Old Norse mythology, but it's this 13th century compendium of myths like brought together by a Christian Icelander called Snorri Sturluson. And we use it as a key for mythology, really, because he collected so much and he's explained it so much more than the poems did beforehand. That's really useful to us. So in that, he has collected these bits and pieces of what Thor might wear in his description of Thor. Outside of that, I think it appears in Þorsdrápa, which is a much earlier poem, like a 10th century poem, I think. So that is attested somewhere else. And it actually plays a crucial role in that poem, because Thor, or Thjalfi, Thor's servant, enslaved person really, is holding on to Thor as they're traversing this river because it's so strong. Only Thor is able to resist the current. But I mean, how widely spread an attribute like that is, I don't think we can say, because they don't appear that much. But obviously the hammer, Mjolnir, that comes up a lot. So yeah, that's his main means of interaction with the world, almost, you could say.
Yeah, yeah.
He's such a violent god. He's all about killing things. So that's really what he does. And it doesn't pop up in every myth. It actually doesn't appear in Þorsdrápa, the poem I just mentioned.
Really?
Yeah, cool. So when Snorri gives like a prose version of it beforehand, and I think he says that it doesn't bring it with him because Loki tricked him, effectively.
Oh, that's
that
deep.
Explains it. I sometimes wonder if the whole poem is really a creation myth. It's like an Iron Man's that origin myth for the hammer, because at the end of it, the person he's battling throws some molten iron at him, and he catches it and throws it back. And it goes through the wall and everything. And I wonder if that iron actually is supposed to be the hammer being formed.
Ooh.
I mean, I'd never written that down because might be not true, but
but again, it's, I mean, it's cool to speculate about those things though, right? Even if you don't have like academic grounds to maybe argue for it in kind of like the sense of a published article, it's still cool to be like,
yeah, I think the mythology is full of that. Those little crumbs, you're like, is this related to this? I can't, maybe, I hope, maybe this is exciting.
I mean, dude, I work with iconography, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, I can imagine. That brilliant, to be honest. That's pretty impressive.
Oh, thank
Just
you.
Making those things out is pretty impressive.
It's a headache, but it's lovely.
Yeah. Obviously, Mjolnir does have its own creation myth, a much more established one, also given by Snorri. You sort of cited it earlier with Sif and her hair.
Yeah.
The story of Mjolnir is basically, if I remember it properly, that Loki's being bold, being a naughty boy, and he cuts off all Sif's hair. And one thing leads to another. He has to remake the hair as gold, effectively. So he gets these Dvergar, these dwarves, to help him make it. They make a bunch of other things as well. And I can't remember. It's essentially a competition to see which one's best.
Mm-hmm.
And he creates, I think he creates the boat as well, Skeiðblatnir, and a couple of other bits and pieces. And yeah, the hammer is the best, but because Loki is a real trickster, he turns into a fly, I think. I haven't read this in such a long time. He turns into a fly and he bites the dwarf making the hammer.
Mm-hmm.
And so the hammer is like the process of making it is damaged. So that's why it's short rather than, supposed to be much longer. Honestly, because that poem or that episode isn't widely attested elsewhere in Old Norse mythology, it's used to make poetry sometimes. You get these canons about what gold is, and it might be related to Sif, for example. But the actual poetry doesn't really echo that many elements of it. The elements of, I think it says in that episode that if he throws Mjolnir, it'll come back to him. You know, that really Marvel, important Marvel sort of dimension. I don't think that's found anywhere else in Old Norse myth.
That's really interesting that like all of these things that have kind of been tied together in story, it's like, do we have grounds to know this for sure? Or did Snorri get this from sources that we don't have anymore? Like where does this come from? Like, not that he's necessarily wrong, but like we can't fact check his sources.
Yeah.
God damn it.
I think a lot of people who come on here are probably quite negative about Snorri, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can't fact check him, as you say, exactly. And he seems to make things up. And sometimes he's definitely influenced by his sort of Christian background, and he equates angels with dwarves and so on. But he's the best we have, and he really seems to be trying to do a good job. In the fishing trip story, for example, he gives two endings because he's not sure which one is the real ending. Or he says this one's more likely. But he does give both endings, for example. So he's clearly trying to do a good job.
Yeah.
I mean, from a scholarly perspective, from that, like literally 1,000 years ago, pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, that is pretty solid work, even though we'd like to have more of his sources and it's unclear when he's making things up. But even the fact that he gives two endings because he's not sure which one is like the quote unquote correct one is that's pretty, that's decent scholarly work.
And I'm sure every scholar would be. They'd rather have the work than not have it. As much as they complain about it, it's so much better to have it and be able to complain about it than it to not exist at all.
We would have no... We have so little information about Old Norse mythology without them. We'd be attempting to pick more of those crumbs and put them together, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about this idea that only Thor can lift Mjolnir? Because that is like a very Marvel thing, like... Only Thor is worthy to pick it, and you get that scene where Captain America kind of moves the hammer just a little bit, and Thor's like, no, come on.
And he spent so many movies building up to that moment as well. It was so worth the payoff.
Yeah. Then he gets stressed out.
Like the cinema audibly gasps, like.
I don't think that's any basis in Old Norse mythology. I don't think so.
For some reason, that's one that stuck with me that I just assumed that was always real. And I I never really questioned it.
Well, so there's a myth called Hrímskvida, which is one of the most famous ones. It's the one where Thor dresses up as a woman, and somebody steals his hammer. So I assume, again, it might be the situation where different people have different ideas about what's capable in relation to the gods. But it seems like if that myth is anything to go by, people can take it.
Yeah, especially. They bring it into the room. I never thought about that. Like, don't they bring it back to him?
Yeah, at the end of it, exactly.
Yeah. There we go. So, trying to think of any other physical things. If you've got any, Margaret, before we move on to
a little bit. Trying to think. Well,
does he have a red cape?
Not that I know of. Again.
He could have.
I mean, just the notion of what we think constitutes a cape and what would be a cape at that time is not necessarily the same.
This is a tangent, but because you do textiles, iconography and textiles, do you know much about what people wore and so on back then?
Okay, are you ready for a rant?
I've said something wrong.
No, you have not said anything wrong, but this is a point of contention that I have with the academic standard of how clothing is interpreted.
Okay.
Is that we have fairly few examples of clothing from this time period, and you can kind of envelop all of Iron Age Scandinavia in that statement. So when I say Iron Age Scandinavia, I mean pretty much everything that is like from around 500 BC up until when we here in Scandinavia deem the Middle Ages to start around the year 1000, depending on if you're Norway, Sweden, or Denmark. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but especially here in Norway, but also other places in Scandinavia, the soil is fairly acidic, so there's not great grounds for conservation of organic materials like textiles, especially if they've been buried. So the places that we would assume that we would find clothing aren't optimal, like in burials and stuff, aren't optimal to preserve it. There are pieces of clothing like Lendesbre tunic that's been found in kind of frozen contexts where the conservation is completely different. So there's a lot of, just like you said with the myths, that there are like bits and pieces that you have to piece together that have been kind of then assembled from the way people are lying, or from inorganic materials like brooches and pieces of metal that's left that they've kind of tried to reinterpret. And I know that there are probably many, many other archaeologists and textile experts that would also maybe correctly disagree with me on this, but I very much, Dan knows this, he's tried to back me into a corner on several fronts and several occasions on this, but I usually love to err on the side of caution, not because I don't want to give a straightforward answer, but because I love nuance. And I love leaving the door open for interpretation. So I would say that we know some things, but the rant that I was kind of referring to was that when I think about iconography and clothing, what we have, what we don't have, what's represented in iconography, is that unfortunately today, from my perspective, clothing is inherently interpreted as something that is gendered. But the people that wear clothing in iconography are surprisingly androgynous. There are very few beards. There are no voluptuous shapes. There are no groins very often that are exaggerated. So there's very little to tell us about the biological sex of the people wearing this. And my rant then comes from the fact that I have been now working for a year to try to dig up where our gendered interpretations come from. Why do we think pants or trousers equals a man, and something that is long, similar to what we would call a dress today, is equal to a woman? Because I don't have an issue with pants being a man and dresses being a woman. I'm just wondering, why do we think that? Where does it come from? And I can't find a single source that gives us a reason as to why we think that. I just find sources saying that's the way it is. And I literally had a conversation with our shared boss about this a few weeks ago, where she also has an issue with this. She's like, I don't know where it comes from, but Both of us have a suspicion that this is probably something that unfortunately has just been inherited from the 19th century and hasn't really been questioned. Because in the 19th century, of course, men would wear trousers and women would wear dresses. So obviously that's the way it had to be in the Iron Age as well. But then to me, interestingly, iconography of kings in the Middle Ages are famously not wearing trousers. They are wearing long outfits often. So that was my rant. I don't know if I've gone on to a tangent or I can't remember your question correctly, but there you go.
But wouldn't that come into... because I guess obviously the most famous skirt-wearing gentleman would be the Scottish and the Irish for wearing the kilts.
I think they ripped it off. I'm not quite sure. I think the Scots were there first.
Probably. But isn't the whole reason for the kilt that it was easier to move quickly across like the Scottish landscape in battle than in a pant? Like that, this is what I was told by a Scotsman when I was attempting to lift this big stone outside his castle, which sounds like a really interesting story. I did like a stone lifting tour, and there was this little castle, and was picking this stone up, and he was telling us about this idea of kilts, that they were used as a basically because they could mobilize, and obviously being quite guerrilla-esque in warfare, I guess. It was easier to move across like the marshland and the rough terrain of Scotland in a kilt rather than like a trouser. So I guess that would kind of make sense if Scandinavians did a similar sort of thing when attacking shores. If it did give some sort of warfare advantage, I think it would make sense. They're certainly not as restrictive. So I agree with you, Margaret.
Well, thank you. I mean, I don't have any grounds for saying that it wouldn't be that or the case. I'm just curious as to why do we even mean it? And like, why is that the kind of consensus in the first place? Where did it come from? I don't have an issue with that being the case. I just want to know why we think that.
I wish I had something useful to say about kilts. I really don't. I'm sorry. But your very polite rant reminded me of, I think it's called the welcome home motif that appears sometimes. And there's versions of that where you have a rider and a person. And I don't think it's really that easy to figure out which gender either of those people are based on their clothing. And I think people are really reassessing that stuff right now. I hope, anyway.
Yeah, I read an article about that exact type of motif. So you got like a rider and then you got a person standing like on what would be surface level, I suppose. And that person is sometimes like seems to be offering like a drinking horn or something of the like to the rider. And I read an article that was published, I think, in 2021 or 2022.
Was it by Leszek Gardewa?
Yeah, and Neil Price. Yeah, where they were really struggling with this, trying to both gender the person or the people, and like also because the person on the horse is seemingly, if you go by the outfit, seemingly a man because there are trousers involved, but then the hairstyle with a hairstyle being like a longer hair but in a knot is often interpreted as being a woman, and this person is wearing both pants and has a knotted hairstyle, so what does that mean? And I'm like, see, this is the problem.
How are we supposed to identify if this is Thor if we can't even like tell what gender? Or the Lyra, the little Lyra figurine, for example, on the throne. Like, that's such a good example of this.
Yes.
We have no idea who that is.
Jesus Christ. Yeah.
It's such a, I've seen that in person, and it's so small. I'm sure maybe you have too. And it's so beautiful.
It's really pretty. And also for the chat, if you guys want, for the Q&A, I can see if I can pull up some pictures of this. So you can see what we're talking about, because I assume that this isn't necessarily iconography that is just wildly.
No,
we got two inside baseball here. Maybe.
I think we've spoken about it before in one of the earlier episodes. I have one last physical question of Thor, and then we can move on to other bits. And that is, I touched on it kind of before the show, this idea that he has a giant whetstone stuck out of his head. Because doesn't that get lodged in there, and then doesn't it say that stays there? But you, never really seen walking around with a big stone stuck out of his head.
I really think that's true. Yeah, this is a bit like the foot through the boat thing. I'm like, somebody put this in the myth, and then nobody else paid attention to it. They kept telling the myth over again, but they just thought, oh, let's just ignore the whetstone in the head part of it. Yeah, the stone's a bit of whetstone, I think. It happens in a fight that he gets into. It crashes. I think his hammer crashes through the whetstone. Jotun, the giant that he's fighting, his whetstone breaks and somehow goes into Thor's head. And then there's an even it finishes with an even stranger episode, I think, where he's on his way home with this stone stuck in his head. He meets somebody, and he's like, "Oh, could you take this whetstone out of my head?" And they start to do some magic, essentially, to take out the stone out. And but then he tells this person that their husband is safe and at home, or something like that. And so the person's like, "Oh, well then I need to go home then." So they just run off, and they don't take the stone. I could be completely mistelling the story.
It's like, okay, sure.
Yeah, I think that's sort of what's happening. I'm gonna go check now. How many details did I get wrong in the Thormas?
We love this because then you can come back and we can be like, the last episode.
So, corrections.
But I also think it's a perfect example of how oral tradition would have gone, because obviously these are stories that you've read, I'm sure, tons. You've read these, you know, time and time again, but you've gone and worked on other things and done other projects. Yeah. And now trying to retell it, you're trying to put it together. And you remember the main parts, but then you have to kind of fill the gaps because they're maybe not as clear. And I imagine that's exactly how oral tradition would have worked, and it's a good example as to why there would be a variation geographically. It wouldn't, it's not a case of you've got this little book and you go, well, this is the story. It's adapted and changed depending on how good somebody's memory was. And I'm sure their memory was probably better than ours today.
Yeah. I think broadly speaking, we can expect people from the Viking Age to have very similar brains to our brains. But even today, we talk so much about how like little kids are so much better with touch screen technology and stuff than we are. Mm-hmm. And so probably the change to literacy does mean the brain develops in a different way, I think. So I think you're right. I think we can assume that their memory would have been much better for these kinds of stories.
Yeah, because I also think that there's a difference in how you would recall things. Because for us, it's just such a default thing that you remember and you recall through writing. But if that's something that you don't interact with on a daily basis, then I suppose, I'm not a cognitive scientist, but I suppose your brain would develop in a way that would remember things or recall things in a slightly different way than we do today, because we use different tools.
Mm-hmm. There's this concept called, I think it's extended cognition. I'm not sure how current it is in cognitive science, but it essentially means that you get the exterior world to do some of the work for you. So exactly. So I think
then
right.
Again, could be related to iconography, you know, like maybe things that we have a hard time picking out today would immediately have, you know, visual clues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's some early poems that are based on iconography. People make up poems just based on, they get a pressing from somebody and make them a poem. Maybe it's about the shield that they got from them and the different stories that are painted on the shield. Or it's at somebody's house and they make a poem about the things that are depicted on the wall of the house. But maybe that fits with your theory.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
I think it's probably worth remembering that, you know, these myths were told, I guess, in most part to entertain people, and they'd be told when you're at home in the winter and it around the fire or in like a hall, and they're made to entertain. So things would be probably fluffed up, bits added, depending on the storytelling, how good they are. You know, you'd keep the key elements, and the rest you'd kind of flow with and add, and probably each time telling would be different because you would add something almost like a stand-up comedian works on the material. The more they do it, the more they find a bit like, oh, this works because this bit got a laugh. This bit maybe didn't work. People yawned during this bit.
I mean,
and
I don't
it was
mean
a
to
living, breathing thing that changes.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right about it being a living, breathing thing, but I hate to be like the party pooper academic, but I don't know if I agree with the whole it changing purely for the sake of entertainment.
I'll let you
No?
two sort this out.
Okay.
I'll step back.
Switzerland?
Yeah, totally. I think there's many different reasons why
definitely
might change, for sure. And maybe some things could be quite incidental, but there's a professor called John McKinnell in Durham who writes really, really well on the concept of change and variety in Old Norse religion. And he, for example, he talks about a poem called Hústadrápa, which is about Thor going fishing. And that poem ends, if I remember right, with Thor killing the serpent, which is obviously an issue if that serpent's supposed to survive until Ragnarok and fight mm-hmm. Thor then instead. So maybe you could be quite free with the myths in some places. Maybe there's more than one version of the story of the Midgard serpent, and maybe that gets adapted to maybe originally Thor did kill the serpent, and then whenever the idea of Ragnarok became much more important to Old Norse mythology and religion, maybe the Thor myth had to adapt to that, so it changed in response to that. But the point that John McKinnell makes, which is really good, is that an audience can disagree as well. Like, it is a living object, as you say, in mythology. So while somebody can change it, everybody else can then say, no, we don't like this, and we're not going to keep this version of it as well. So we have to assume to some extent that a myth that survived had some kind of consensus behind it, I think. That
That's
enough people
really
liked it
interesting.
For it to survive. Because it's an oral culture until, like the 1200s, 1100s. And the myths aren't getting written down until the 13th century, for sure. So, I think that's important.
Mm-hmm.
I'm big on this idea of, there's many different, there's technology for memorization, which is obviously important. We have two different types of poetry. We've got skaldic poetry and Eddic poetry. And the skaldic poetry is really, it's more rigid than Eddic poetry in terms of how it's remembered. So that's less likely to change. So if you tell a myth in skaldic poetry, it's probably going to be told for generations in a similar way to the original composition. But the Eddic poetry, the more famous poems, like Grimskilda, Völuspá, those kinds of poems, they could change much more freely over time. And it's presumably up to the poet to remember it properly. But the process of remembering and telling, people are working on that now, I think, and they're doing really interesting stuff. Like Claire Mulley, who's been on this podcast before, she's really interested in that now. And she thinks there's even, they build in pauses in the poems to give, that's like when you get a refrain in a poem, then maybe that's where the poet's going, what's next? Okay, give me a second. I'll tell this bit and then we'll move on again.
Mm-hmm.
But,
that's
yeah.
really interesting. I recently read, this is from a while ago, it's published, but that made me think of Guro Steinsland, who's a religious historian who's worked a lot with Norse mythology, especially in the 90s and early 2000s, where it was just like kind of a sentence in a book that I have by her, where she just kind of mentioned, and I haven't looked into this further, but that a possible origin of the word Edda to begin with is the word for a great grandmother, and that potentially that could hearken to older women being kind of responsible for passing on knowledge. And I thought that was just kind of an interesting detail, especially with the point you just made about Eddic poetry being more kind of fluid.
Yeah. I'd never thought of that before. But we have this idea of older people definitely as retaining legal knowledge, at least. That's been really well written on before. We get these lists of poetic words which are kept in things called, I think it's Thuler or Thula. And that actually is another word for an old wise person who's retaining this information as well. But we tend to gender that. We tend to think of them as old wise men. But we also have this idea that the Eddic poems especially are handed down by women in the house. And that's maybe why there's like more of a Celtic influence. Like, that's an idea from the 80s. I have no idea if people are still writing about that. But
that's interesting.
But so, I mean, the gendered idea of who's passing on mythology. Yeah, I mean, that's... Mm-hmm. I don't know how people have actually properly looked at that.
No, me neither.
It might be, but it might be that the word is actually gendered, but I can't remember. I can't tell.
And I should note, just for future ref, if anyone's like listening to this later on, I want to just kind of emphasize that this was just put in there as a possible meaning of the word, not a definite.
Nobody knows what it means.
Yeah.
You're right.
No.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Perfect. Okay. I kind of touched on it before. I would love to know your thought on how accurate the myths we have can be, particularly the written down ones. Because obviously we have that influence, and you get the stories. So let's say, I guess, you know, Thor losing his hammer, having to dress up as a woman, or the story of Utgarda Loki, where Thor effectively is embarrassed and loses because everything you expect Thor to be able to do, he can't do, and he's outmatched in all fields of things that he would usually excel at. And I wondered whether these would be traditional parts of the myth, or would they be, these stories have been tweaked when written down by Christians to kind of like, oh, we want to write this down as like part of the history of what these people believed before us, but they were wrong, so we're going to add these aspects in that humanize them and don't kind of, I guess, almost don't breathe life back into this belief.
That's a really good question. And it's definitely one of those questions that we cannot answer completely. Because even where we have a feature of mythology that crops up in Christian texts, and which maybe might have influenced it, we can't guarantee that that people from the north who hadn't come into contact with Christianity just didn't come up with the same idea. The most famous example of this is probably the idea of Odin hanging himself. That could be Christian influence. It might not be. Even if it is, we don't know when that influence came into Norse religion. If it came in the 700s, does it matter that it was Christian influence? It's a functional part of the religion for people for a really long time. So the question of authenticity is a really difficult one, I think. I would, though, I mean, answering sort of the spirit of the question, I think I tend to allow for the possibility that the myths have a long history in the Old Norse religion. Srimskvida, the poem of Thor dressing up as a woman, for example, we can date poems to some extent. They're oral documents, so they're changing over time anyway. So it's the idea of dating them, again, is difficult. But people using linguistics can try to. Some of those people using linguistics date that poem to like the 1100s, maybe. Other people did it to the 900s.
Well, so, that's a big difference.
Yeah, it is.
So it's really hard to know. The most recent dating, which coming from somebody who isn't experienced with this field at all, it dated to the 900s, a book by somebody called Christopher Sapp, which seems a really competent book, at least. So this we can date these things to some extent. I think Thrymskvida is a good example too. Because it's a poem, like, as you said, this mockery of Thor in some of these poems. In another poem, Harbarth the Oath, that mockery might be because Thor seems to be against Odin in the myth. And so maybe there's like an element of cult competition between the two of them. That's always been the idea, that somebody who is a huge Odin worshipper has composed it to make fun of Thor. And that's definitely possible, because Thor's attitude in that poem to everything Odin's doing is this kind of like childish curiosity almost. He's getting mocked with this guy the whole way through the poem. He's being made to look like an idiot, but he really wants to find out what Odin did. He's like sort of titillated almost by what's happening in the poem. In Thrymskvida, though, Thor is made fun of, but the process of him, so he's feminized for a long time in the poem. He has to dress up, he loses the hammer, but the hammer is quite obviously, I don't normally go for phallic symbolism, but this one is so obvious. You can't
It's hard to ignore it. Yeah.
Yeah. So he gets his hammer's taken away from him. And Freya, this woman in his life, she starts off so meek and demure and the perfect woman. And then soon she's shouting at him, and she's the power in the poem. So Thor is suddenly feminized. The woman in the poem is suddenly a masculine sort of identity going on. And he's dressed up as a woman, and then he goes and he gets his hammer back, and suddenly he gets his masculinity back. He even put his hammer in his lap. That's how obvious the symbolism is, you know? So he gets his hammer back and he destroys all of the giants that are in the room with him. He's supposed to get married to one of them, an ogre. And it tells the story of killing all of the giants in one stanza. And then it spends an entire stanza talking about how he killed the ogre's sister. So it's like, it's this complete reaffirmation of the status quo. All unnatural women are either destroyed or returned to their proper place in society. And Thor, you know, is also returned to his hyper-masculine, like, rightful status in society too. So,
well, shit.
I think that's what's happening in that poem. And generally, we can look at these poems from two perspectives. It's possible as Christian, it's possible that Lokasenna, the story of the god being made fun of as Christian. But equally, if we look at it from that lens without coming already with the idea that these things are Christian or Old Norse, we just look at the evidence, it gets a lot harder to come to firm conclusions about one way or the other about that particular question. I tend to err on the side of caution and then probably cautious optimism, because if they aren't Old Norse documents, then I don't have evidence.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Wonderful. That's
a very long-winded answer. Sorry. Yeah.
No, I love that. I love that.
I love it. Yeah.
Actually, do you mind if I interrupt you for a second?
Yeah, you go.
We were sort of talking about theology earlier as well, Old Norse theology. Like this idea that you have the myths, and then you have things outside of the myths in which the gods might be represented in a different way. We might even have, maybe there's a history of people intellectualizing the myths, you know, talking around them and essentially doing like exegesis is what it's called in Christian traditions, at least. And those kinds of elements of religion, they are likely to be forgotten. Partly they might be gotten rid of by Christians, as I think you sort of hinted at earlier. Why would a Christian keep this, these texts, I guess, about the gods, the Old Norse gods, being powerful enough or godlike enough to challenge the Christian God in any way? It's easier if they are silly myths, you know, there's silly stories about gods dressing up in women's clothing or changing into whatever they change into, a donkey or a horse or female horse or whatever. But also they're very hard to memorize. You know, if you tell a myth, you're telling something that's exciting. You're telling a fun story. A lot of the elements of it, they might change over time to keep it exciting, as you mentioned before, to keep it surprising to the audience. But that other kind of text, the more theological text, unless you're learning every word rote by rote by rote, that's just not going to survive outside of a literate culture.
Mm-hmm.
So some religions do keep those texts by rote learning, but not the Old Norse one, as far as we can tell. And maybe they didn't exist, but I also think it's one of those areas where we have so much absence that we can't say anything about it except to go, that's interesting.
Yeah. Do you think it makes the gods more relatable to the people in sort of Vikingish Scandinavia, I guess, because the gods are humanized a little bit and you can make fun of them and they're not some distant being that is faceless. You can kind of, they tease them, they make mistakes, but obviously they come back and kind of fix them, and they're more like you and I.
It could be. I guess maybe it's nice, just completely speculatively, just talking about from my personal perspective, if these gods, these people that you put your trust in to order the world, if bad things happen to them and they fix it every time, you know, that must be a nice, comforting feeling. And I think that's one of the elements of Old Norse religion, especially probably most historical religions that we lose. It's what does it feel like to be a worshiper of these gods? You know, Thor, especially, he's maybe the easiest person to talk about from this perspective, because we have a god who has a huge impact on the natural landscape. One of my big ideas has always been that we have, like, you associate Thor with thunder, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, his name means thunder. So clearly at some stage there was an association with that. In Sweden, we have a little bit of connection with Ymir Thunder. In Norway, we have a little bit of connection with Ymir Thunder as well. In Iceland, we almost don't have any. And we have all of the evidence about the god from Iceland. So that disappears. Instead, maybe we have a bit of a connection with volcanoes. And all these are different ways of like connecting the god to the landscape, probably related to how strong he is. And again, so change, variety happening. But that's also you're feeling your god in that landscape. You know, if you're in Germany in the year 600 and you're interested in the proto Thor that was there, that thunder, is that fearsome? Is that like a reassuring thing? It probably means that you can feel Thor is out there fighting trolls, fighting people who might steal your children, sour your milk at least, you know, somebody's out there protecting you. But it's also scary. So like the feeling of what it might be like to worship such a powerful, strong god can be reassuring, maybe. You can be a great friend to this person, as they say in some sagas. But
I
maybe
love
it's also
that.
terrifying.
Thor's out there protecting children and protecting your milk.
Yeah.
The juxtaposition between those two things is beautiful.
I think it's what Thunderstones. We don't have any references, I think, to Thunderstones really in the west of Scandinavia so much, definitely not in Iceland. But in the east, Denmark, Thunderstone ideas do survive from early modern period and later. And they're often used against trolls. So they keep trolls away. And souring milk is one of the big things I think the trolls do.
I mean,
And they all, yeah.
that would be a part of the sustenance, right? So, like,
yeah.
but I do
It
also
would be a big
wonder,
thing.
yeah, but I do also wonder, I don't know if you have an opinions on any opinions on this, Declan, but like, I wonder if just from the tiny evidence that we do have of kind of pre-Christian Norse beliefs, I do, and we can't quantify this or fact check it by any means necessarily, but I do wonder if to what degree they needed to be changed. Like, since it seems like such a different mindset and such a different way of interacting with the world and believing about like higher powers or whatever, insert whatever word you'd like. I wonder if there's also like a case to be made for did any like Christian author really need to change that much for it to seem weird, for lack of a better term? Just because now suddenly the world is organized in a completely different way, and the mindset has, from what we can tell, shifted so dramatically.
It's a very interesting question. I love it. I don't know. It makes me reminds me of there are some stanzas of poetry from around the year 1000. I think it's late 10th, early 9th, early 11th. We're not really sure when. By a guy called Hallfreðr Oddursson. He's known as the Wandering Skald, I think, in his book. And he's got these famous conversion verses, which are he's being forced to convert by, I think it's Ólafur Tryggvason,
Sounds like him.
and he doesn't, he's a bit reluctant. And as you go through the verses, he gets more and more, okay, maybe I will. Okay, I hate Odin, I hate Thor, fine. They can be angry with me, I don't care. But he's really expressing his fear of Jesus in a way that isn't that dissimilar from his fear of the Old Norse gods. He's saying that the power of Jesus essentially is greater than the Old Norse gods. And for that reason, I will worship Jesus effectively. There's more to it. It's more subtle than that. But it's definitely a while at least in which the mindset isn't necessarily different. I suppose that's if somebody's
Yeah,
converting
that's
during their
cool.
life, you know.
Yeah, that's a cool point. Yeah.
Maybe in the, I mean, when we're talking of Snorri Sturluson, that's a lot later. That's like 13th century that I think we're supposed to date the Edda to. So, yeah, I can imagine that in Iceland, we still have pagan sacrifices until the late 11th century, at least. But still, that's 100 years afterward of Christianization. More than that, probably. It's 200 years since the conversion of Iceland, official conversion of Iceland. So that's a lot of time for a mindset to change. I think it's a really good question because I'm never sure how much one religion is really that different from another one. Because everybody who is in a religion wants certain things. They want protection, they want salvation, maybe. they want, you know, there's certain psychological benefits they want from it. So I don't know. Definitely they are different. They have different frames of reference and so on. I don't know. As you can tell, I love the question. I don't know how to answer
Yeah,
it.
and I don't really know what my opinion on it is either. But I'm
If
just
you just
like,
want to go off and write a huge paper about it,
yeah.
yeah. So it's really good. You should write that paper, I guess.
I mean, let me know if you want to collaborate on that
That
at some point.
sounds cool.
Wonderful. Okay, I've got two questions I want to ask before we wrap up and do the Q&A where we let the patrons ask you some questions. If anybody wants to get the Q&As, as I said before the show, it's on Patreon Nordic Mythology Podcast. You get all the Q&As we do with all the guests after the show on the lowest tier, it's £3 a month. And it's basically just an extension of the main show where we just chat for maybe another half an hour, 20 minutes. All the patrons get to ask questions. There's a bunch of questions that me and Margaret probably have missed. The patrons always come from a different angle sometimes of just things that we've overlooked. So they're always pretty good. And there's a bunch of knowledge to be had in there. So that is just Patreon Nordic Mythology Podcast. But my last two that spring to mind. The first one is, I can't remember who it was that was on here. We were talking about Mjolnir's the been found in graves, the little
Dependence, yeah.
the pendants.
I was
And
thinking
they
about that
said,
earlier too. Yeah.
and they said how they were pretty much exclusively found in female graves. And I wondered your thought on that when it comes to Thor being this very hyper masculine figure that you would think would be associated mainly with men, particularly warrior men, and you would have this idea of mainly like warriors wearing the little hammer pendant, taking them into battle for protection. But the evidence seems to suggest that it was mainly women that wore the little Mjolnir pendants. Yes, Margaret, thank you for putting your hand up.
Can I add a caveat question
Of course
before
you can.
Declan even gets to that? Do you have an opinion on whether or not those pendants can even be attributed to Mjolnir specifically?
I will answer that one first because I find that one easier. Well, I mean, for a long time, we couldn't be sure that was even a hammer. There's a Danish scholar called, I think it's Lasse Kristian Arvosana, something like that. I'm very sorry for the mispronunciation of everything.
Fine.
He wrote a book about Thor. It was really good. It was tearing everything apart. It was the most, we have no evidence, and therefore we don't know anything book. And I liked it a lot. It got some, you know, it got criticized for being so hardcore in that direction because if we don't have evidence, we can't say anything. So should we just not do history, you know, if we don't have anything reliable? Which is fair too.
I
But
love those works because then you kind of have to rebuild.
yeah, there's a nice tension there actually. And I like his kind of work, and I like the other people that are much more open. I think that's productive academia in a way. But I felt bad for him because he published and he spent like 7 pages being like, we don't even know this is a hammer. And then maybe a year later, we found a little pendant that said, this is a hammer on it. So we can't say it's definitely Mjolnir. For me, it seems.
Imagine if somebody found that and then just wrote it in there just to piss him off and then put it back in the ground and was like,
But thank
just to
God it was
get
found
it.
after the publication of the book and
Oh,
not right
yeah.
before.
Well, I feel bad for him either way, I suppose.
Yeah,
It's a lot
that's
more
true.
work, but he could have fixed it.
Yeah, that's
Yeah.
true.
But, you know. So I think it's a good point. Like, as with almost any iconography, it's difficult to be sure that it is definitely Mjolnir. I would say that in this case, it's most likely to be that. I would go, yeah, probably. We can't say that every woman figurine or even any woman figurine is a Valkyrie. But I think because we find the hammer, it seems a lot like a hammer so much in iconography as well, on stones that are raised and quite similar shapes to, for example, the Thor holding the hammer, Thor's huge association with the hammer, the popularity of Thor in all of these places across Scandinavia. I don't know how much commonality there is between, I think we find the pendants in quite specific places in different periods as well, but I don't know if there's much crossover between place names, for example, and these finds. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. But I would err on the side of saying, yeah, probably. especially because we find other pendants that maybe we can associate with gods. Although I think that gets harder at that point. But yeah, I don't. Do you have a perspective? I'd love to hear it, actually, if you do, either way.
I am fairly comfortable with it being a hammer, but I feel like I haven't looked into it enough to have an opinion on whether or not it can be contributed to Mjolnir, but I'm not necessarily against it being Mjolnir.
But then
comes back to Dan's question about it primarily being like overwhelmingly, like an overwhelming amount of them being found in female, what is interpreted as female burials, both biologically and typologically meaning that we identify female attributed objects if there isn't a skeleton left. But like that comes back to that question of like, if he's like the masculine that ever masculined, what would then this being overwhelmingly found in what's gendered as female graves come down to? I don't know. I want to let you answer that before I have an opinion.
I really don't have a good answer to that one, so I can't wait to hear your opinion on that one then. Can I go back to the caveat question, actually, for 1 second? There's a stone called the Henning Stone, I think, from Denmark. Henninger, maybe? Stone from Denmark. And that has a hammer on it. And that seems like that isn't related to Thor. Actually, that one's probably too late, is the idea. So that definitely makes the situation more ambiguous. And a lot of the hammer, these little hammer symbols that do appear on them, almost like swastikas, and a lot of stones from Denmark and Sweden in that period. And they are so ambiguous as to be anything, I think. They're a lot harder to say than the pendants. But equally, and I keep going, this is how I write as well. Everything is, we have this evidence, but we also have this evidence. But no, there's this piece of evidence. I don't know if you know about the Thorvigi runic inscriptions, if anyone does. There's 4 inscriptions we find on grave monuments in southern Sweden and Denmark, in which Thor is asked to bless either the monument or the runes themselves, which is a really interesting circular blessing. Why do you want to bless the thing that's doing blessing, you know? I think that works like holy water. I think it's this transportable sort of inscription. You put it on anything, it does whatever you want to. But this, again, going back to John McKinnell, who I mentioned earlier, he's done a book with Rudolf Simek where they look at all the runic inscriptions that might be related to religion. And they suggest that maybe the Thor runic inscription, the Thorvig inscription, and the little Thor hammer symbols are the same. That the hammer symbols are just visual representations on monuments that are put there instead of the inscriptions. I don't know if it works. I think maybe you'd have to go through all of the inscriptions and check. And I don't think all of them would function that way because there's so much other, many other types of symbols on those stones. Some of them are Christian elements, for example, I think. Then maybe that gets harder. But yeah, that's a footnote to what we were saying earlier. And now we have to go back to the question I don't have a clue why.
If you don't know, if you don't have an answer, you don't have an answer. That's right.
I just don't know the pendants very well. As a historian of religion, which is kind of what I primarily think of myself as, you end up as a very much a jack of all trades. And the trade in which I'm the least jack of is probably archaeology. I really don't know much about it in general, or even the sort of history of the pendants. So I can't, I have to trust you really when you say that most of the women's groups. It reminds me of something I read 10 years ago. So I'd say you're probably right. He is definitely in the mythology very associated with women, with preserving the status quo related to women. He protects women a lot. He protects his daughter, for example, from being married to a Turger, the dwarf, which obviously nobody would want. I think he kills more women than he kills men. Yeah, he's not a guy. He's not a very good guy.
No.
Yeah, that's nasty. Even one of the poems is a poem called Hundljot, in which it says early on, there's a giantess, let's call her, who is attempting to get the favor of Odin and Thor, more or less. It's kind of a complicated start, it's a bit weird. But the Frey is attempting to help this giantess, and there's a bit of back and forth, essentially because they think Thor's never going to help a giantess. He's just not into it. So, yeah, his relationship with women is difficult. and it really does seem to be all about maintaining the status quo. I think he protects people in general, but I think he probably is slightly more associated with protecting women, with looking after women. And maybe that's partly why, in that, again, I keep going back to Trimskvile, just a deep well. Mm-hmm. In that poem, his hammer is stolen and the ogre wants to marry Freya, essentially. And that's why he pretends to be Freya. He dresses up as a woman and he goes off to marry the ogre. I think maybe that's one of those places in which this just flipping upside down your entire conception of what Thor is. It's playing with that. It's kind of teasing him by saying, this is the opposite of what Thor should do. Thor should be protecting Freya in this situation. And in one other case, after this is a famous war between the Aesir and the Vanir, between the two families of gods, essentially. And the wall of Asgard is knocked down. They need to rebuild it. They get this giant builder in, which is a motif that appears throughout folklore in Scandinavia for a long time afterwards. And they end up promising to the giant builder that he can have the sun, the moon, and Freya as a wife, I think.
Yeah.
And Thor essentially says, we can't have this. You know, and he kills, even though he shouldn't, he breaks the oaths and everything, and he kills this builder to protect Freya. So I think, yeah, he is hyper-masculine, but maybe especially associated with protection of women, and probably because of that hyper-masculinity. It was a big deal in the early medieval period, the Iron Age. Mm-hmm. Who got married to who had access to the women in your household. Yeah, as far as I know, anyway.
I feel like that kind of answered the question, to be completely honest with
you.
I very quickly was like, let's move away from graves.
No, but does he, like, I don't know what the graves mean, but from my experience, he is very much associated with, you know, women. And I'm like, okay, cool. That answers the question.
You did a good job.
He's such a happy, creepy guy.
Okay. My last one before we wrap up and let the patrons ask some questions. The Gosforth cross. Hmm. Are you familiar with it?
Again, I haven't looked at it in a while. But yeah, it's this kind of... I appreciate you asking me this time before. So let's say I'm and move on. Yeah.
I guess the question is... I guess first of all, I find it a very fascinating cross. And am I right in thinking... that there is, it reminded me, I thought of it earlier when you mentioned Thor fighting Jormungandr, because isn't that one of the images on there? But am I right in thinking that above Thor, there is an image of the Christian god holding a snake, kind of in like this weird, I can do what you can't do kind of image. And I don't know whether I've just read that as maybe somebody's interpretation of it, and I'm not sure if that's 100% accurate, but I found that quite interesting, this idea that there is a picture of Thor kind of doing this thing that he's known for, especially for the most part is associated for not killing Jormungandr, and then the idea that kind of the Christian god is like, oh well, you can't do it, I can do it, and this is the snake.
I think you answered your own question. I think, honestly, it's basically a Christian document. And we talked a little bit earlier about whether Christians needed to change the mythology or not. And I think that's this the cross is so interesting because it is, I mean, it's carved by Christians. And I think you're right that there's a Christian message happening there, depicting and retaining the old mythology, but then giving it a new meaning for the new world, maybe. So maybe it brings in topics that both of you brought up earlier. Actually, again, the Gosforth cross isn't something I'm that familiar with. I haven't looked at it in a long time, but I wish it's definitely very cool.
I wish they'd protect it. It's just kind of out there.
I mean, I thought it was inside. I think I went to visit it once, and it was. I thought it was inside of a church.
Oh, is it inside? I thought it was outside. I've never been there
in a long time.
But all the images I've seen of it were kind of outside, and it looks.
I could
very
be mixing up with another cross.
This seems like a very relevant theme to one of those videos you do on Instagram, Dan.
Maybe
you go and visit.
I would like to go and visit it. It's about 3 hours away, and it's one place that I really want to go and see.
Excuses.
I know. I will go because there was the same idea with someone theorizes similar thing with the bound devil stone, which is the one that people often associate with being Loki. This is the figure of like a kind of figure bound across the middle with like a chain, and the hands are bound. And it looks as if it's part of like a cross shaft, and the idea is that possibly there was like a Christian God above it, in a sense of like I can bind the devil, as whether it is Loki. I don't know. I'm not really too sure why it's attested so much with Loki, the bound devil stone. I don't know if I agree that it is Loki, but I think it gets classed as one of the two depictions of Loki. But it could be quite cool to have this like idea of.
Yeah.
Similar way to the gospel cross of like the Christian God kind of doing what the Nordic gods couldn't do.
Yeah. And kind of removing the threat of the end of the world as well.
Like
that's a
good
point.
Religion is interesting because it is this kind of millenarian religion, if that's how you pronounce that word. Like you're always scared that the world's about to end.
But it doesn't like this. I know we're about to go into the Q&A, Dan, but like on that note, my perception of it is like, yeah, the world is going to end, but it seems like there is this self-continuation where it's like, yeah, the world ends, but it doesn't. Mm-hmm. Like, it starts anew and then rinse and repeat.
Mm-hmm. That's the major impression that we have from the mythology that survives. That's the dominant one. There's kind of two different visions of the end of the world.
Yeah, because I've struggled with understanding that.
Yeah,
I gotta admit.
Like the version from Völuspá is kind of as you suggest, and Baldur comes back, and so does his brother, and everything's seems like it might be pretty good again, at least for a while. In Vafthrúðnismál, another poem, really important poem, the world is set to end, and some humans just hide in a forest, and they escape the end of the world, basically.
Cool times.
And one of the, like Njord, I think it is, one of the Vanir, the other family of gods that isn't related to Thor, he just goes back home. He avoids the whole battle and everything. Just says he leaves. Yeah, I think if
he
I
just
remember
goes,
right.
Nope.
Yeah, I'm not interested in this. I didn't sign up for this. And so the world survives in that one too. But it seems like it's more of survival than this like cyclical.
Okay, so it's more of an apocalypse type thing than a rebirth.
Well, I think the word is not reborn, but regenerate, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, you do have the last generation of gods dying, but there's a symbolism in that instead of Baldur and his brother surviving, they have Thor's children instead picking up his hammer.
Yeah.
Actually, I think they pick up his hammer. Do I remember that right?
Wow.
That might be wrong.
No, it's kind
I have
of
a terrible memory. I really do have a terrible memory. So I'm a bad example of oral transmission of information here. Mm-hmm. Actually, the Gosford cross is almost definitely outside. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. I feel like it's getting more and more weathered, which is disappointing.
Oh, Magni, according to the chat. So
perfect. Okay, let's wrap this up and then people can ask you some questions. So if anybody does want that again, it's just patreon.com/NordicMythologyPodcast. You get all the back catalog. Margaret, let's start with you. What are your places where people can find you and what you do?
Well, as per usual, I'm pretty much just focusing on Instagram at the moment when I do post things occasionally. So that's ArchaeoMags on Instagram, Archaeo with a K.
Well, that's perfect. Yeah, Declan, plug anything where you want people to find you. Or if you don't want anyone to find you, then plug the game again. Or do both.
I'd like to plug the game again, I guess. I mean, obviously, I get paid for it. So I have an interest in doing this. But I hope people like it as well. You know, I want people to play it and like it. It's a weird, I spent such a long time on it that I hope people do like it. You can find the game Choice of the Viking on Steam, on Play Store, maybe Apple Store too, I think. And if anyone would like to get into contact with me, they can find me on Twitter at DC Taggart. I don't use social media very much though.
Okay.
I'm very sorry about that.
Apologize.
No. If somebody actually wants to write me a message, the best place to get me might be on academia.edu. And I will respond to any message that I notice has appeared in my inbox. And I'm very sorry to anyone who's messaged me in the past and I didn't notice. But some really nice people message me sometimes. Nice. So.
That's the politest plug I've ever heard in my life.
It is. It is, yeah. So everybody go and buy the game and play the game.
Yes.
I'm going to I'll give you some feedback and let you know.
I appreciate it, really.
Can
only get better.
Yeah, wonderful. And if you want to follow me, it's Daniel_Farrand1. Still someone out there with it, and they don't use it, and it drives me insane. I want to get rid of the
Ugh.
one, but and then yeah, just the business, Hornsworth, and then again, Nordic Mythology Podcast across the board. I'm just working on some cool designs. We're going to be releasing some new merch soon, so that will be fun. But yeah, let's jump over and do a Q&A. So Declan, thank you for the main show, and then hopefully people will follow us over and hear a little bit more.